Hi, I'm your friend Claude, and I want to welcome you to the debut of yet another new segment here on the Nerd Bomber Podcast. This one is called
3, 2, 1,
Pop.
On here, we're going to be discussing a specific month from 3 decades ago, 2 decades ago, and 1 decade ago, respectively. And since we are currently in the month of August, we are starting with August, oddly enough. Who wants to go first?
Well, I haven't been on in a while, so I think you can go first.
It's not the way I was expecting that to go. Okay. We're going to start with August of 1988, which is shocking to believe is 30 years ago, but it is. And for my pick for 1988, I have chosen the debut of a summer tradition in professional wrestling. That's right. I'm talking about the very first SummerSlam. This took place on August 29th, 1988 at Madison Square Garden in New York City, a venue you and I have been to more than once in our short lives. The highlights from the very first SummerSlam include the Honky Tonk Man's record intercontinental title reign, which still stands as the longest ever to this day at 454 days, being broken when the Ultimate Warrior defeated him in 31 seconds for his first championship title win ever. I don't know if that was his debut, but it was pretty early on in the Warrior's WWF run. So he kind of came out of the gate swinging at full power.
I always said that the Ultimate Warrior and Goldberg kind of had almost like a parallel kind of thing going on. I mean, not at the same time, obviously, but their careers were kind of the same in a sense that, you know, the Ultimate Warrior would come out and would beat someone in like less than a minute. You know, he was like the Mike Tyson of wrestling in his day.
Also notable was a rare instance of Bret Hart eating the pin as the Hart Foundation unsuccessfully attempted to win back their tag team title belts from reigning champions Demolition, who, until 2016, also had the longest reign with their belts at 478 days. And that record stood for 28 years. And now a team called the New Day holds the record at 483, so just barely edging them out, which is pretty lame. Finally, most fans remember the very first SummerSlam for the main event, which was a tag team match between the legendary team of Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage, known collectively as the Mega Powers.
The Mega Powers against the Mega Bucks. Four individuals that definitely have their sights set on each other. Monday night, August 29th at SummerSlam 88. And right now, standing by are the Mega Powers, Hulk Hogan, and the Macho Man, Randy Savage.
Thank God, Macho Brother. I got the Mega Power Psycon going in the 11th hour of this thing because it makes me realize just how large the task is we have to complete. That just tells me and you what we have to do about the situation.
Yeah, but at the SummerSlam in Madison Square Gardens,
what is it?
I want you to do me a favor. I want you to set up the million-dollar man.
Oh, yeah.
So I can slam him in the middle of the ring and go to the top rope and jump off and crush him with my big elbow.
They were going against the villainous team of Andre the Giant and the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, who called themselves the Mega Bucks in response. And the match also had the legendary Jesse the Body Ventura as special guest referee. And he had just appeared at the time in the movies Predator and The Running Man, both with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And it's oddly enough, it's funny to note that they would both go on to become state governors, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, that is kind of weird.
So besides all that star power, the reason people really remember this match is the moment when Miss Elizabeth enables the Mega Powers to secure the win by getting up on the apron to argue with Jesse Ventura and then ripping off her skirt to distract the other team so that Hogan and Savage can each land their finisher on DiBiase. And of course, Hogan gets the pin, which solidifies the Mega Powers as a team and makes SummerSlam 88 a memorable part of pro wrestling history.
Well, my first thoughts are, I remember that, but I think it's kind of odd that they had her take her skirt off to distract them. Because that's not, I mean, that is kind of distracting when a woman is like fully dressed but not wearing pants. There's just something that doesn't fit right with that, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do remember that. I was really we were both really young, so it's kind of funny that you know, I can remember that vividly. But I think I was probably more confused on why, since I was seven, you know, and why that was distracting. I don't know, but.
Well, I definitely remember the mega powers being a thing. Mm-hmm. At the time, it was probably the year or the year before I really got into watching wrestling, because I would only watch it on like Saturday morning. So I would just see whatever like still picture recap they would show from like the big events. But obviously they were still promoting the hell out of the big stars. I mean, you would never see Hogan or Savage wrestle on Saturday morning, but you would see all the hype from whatever happened, you know, yeah, on prime time or whatever, or in pay-per-view.
Well, you'd also, if you did see, you know, a big name wrestle on the Sunday show or whatever, it wouldn't be against another big wrestler. It'd be some, you know,
yeah,
tool. So it was, I remember that was kind of, it kind of stink, because I had to wait until it came out on VHS to rent it.
Yeah.
So I could see what actually happened and watch the big matches. But yeah, it was just weird. Like on Sunday or Saturday morning, now it's like completely different. I mean, when we were, you know, when WCW is at its height, I mean, Goldberg beat Hulk Hogan on Monday Nitro, which you never would have saw a match like that, you know, in the WWE in like 1988 or whatever.
Right.
But yeah, that was pretty cool. I do remember, you know, the Mega Powers and stuff like that also. That was kind of big. I remember they had their little rivalry too, you know, around that time.
Yeah.
Also,
it was I don't know if this even lasted for a full year, but of course this led to them, you know, having a snafu and then becoming rivals.
Yeah.
But the taking off the skirt thing, I think, I mean, it was a big deal at the time because they didn't really ever have like a remotely sexual angle much in mainstream mm-hmm. wrestling. And especially the Miss Elizabeth character was kind of the opposite of that. It was always like super classy and demure and all that. So I guess behind the scenes, apparently she even like put up kind of a fight to doing it because she didn't think it was consistent with her character. But mm-hmm. Vince McMahon gets what he wants in the end.
Yeah,
I mean, it was a big deal. Everybody remembers it, so I guess they did something right.
See SummerSlam 88, Monday night, August 29th at 8 p.m. on a pay-per-view basis of SummerSlam 88, a pay-per-view event, Monday night, August 29th.
That was a good pick, sir.
Well, thank you.
Well, in venturing into the wide world of sports again, my pick was on August 6th, Oakland Athletics outfielder Jose Canseco becomes the 11th Major League Baseball player to record 30 home runs and 30 steals in a season.
Nice.
Now, later on that year, you become the first ever player to record 40 home runs and 40 steals in a season, so he was the first 40-40 man, they called it.
He's leaning a little bit right now. He's running. There's the throw.
And he's saying no.
The umpire says he can't have it. He's getting a standing ovation from his teammates on the top of the dugout steps.
And the fans. And the fans are standing also.
So,
damn, both in the same year.
Yeah, it was the same year. Well, because like the season would go until September. So I think he did it later in the season because, you know, at the time, you know, it still takes you a while to culminate your stats or whatever. But I picked that I would say because like 1988 was when I was a kid, it was my first memorable, or not really memorable, but the first time I can remember being interested in like baseball cards and like really interested in baseball.
Right.
And there's always like some phenom player that everybody likes and you have to get their cards because they're worth money. And Jose Canseco was that guy at that time. I mean, my favorite player when I was a kid was Daryl Strawberry, hands down. I also like Howard Johnson from the Mets as well. But, you know, Jose Canseco is like, if you had a Jose Canseco card, you could go to the card shop, you know, and sell it for a couple bucks if you wanted.
Yeah.
Get something else. Or, you know, or he was the guy. He was like the hobby guy at the time. So I picked that just because it's, it was a time, when you're like a kid, it's like one of those memories you have as a child where it's like everything's perfect, it's awesome, and then it's like hopelessly crushed like 20 years later. He only did that because he was on steroids. So it was significant because I just remember, those early days of me collecting baseball cards and stuff, and then being naive to the fact that, he was just like this great, amazing baseball player that everybody loved. And it turns out he was doing steroids the whole time. So, yeah, thanks a lot, buddy.
Well, at least it turned out that pretty much all of them were.
Yeah,
in one form or another.
Like Mark Wire and, all those guys. But that's what I picked.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the same story for me. Probably got into collecting cards right on the same time. I think that probably explains why, if you go back and look at like the few pages of cards that I still have from my youth, most of them are from 1988. I forget, it might have been, I think it was Don Russ. They had like that blue border with like the red like pole looking thing in the middle of it. Like,
yes, a
little streak of red.
That was 88. Yep.
So many of those.
Well, the funny thing too is I remember back in 1988, you could buy packs of baseball cards like anywhere. I mean, you could go to the drugstore, you go to the gas station, you go to Bill Brothers on the corner of the street I grew up on, which is basically just like a dairy convenience type store. They had baseball cards there. I mean, it was crazy. You could get them anywhere, but now it's like, it's more like a big box store or like a card shop thing. Like, you can't just get a pack. I mean, I see packs of cards like in a weird spot sometimes, but it's just like they're not as prevalent as they were back then. They used to go basically anywhere.
Well, like you said, the gas station used to be my number one source for most kinds of cards, but especially baseball cards. And I don't think I've seen a gas station sell cards of any kind in years. I mean, I've run, Walmart still carries them, and then, like, I've seen some here and there in dollar stores and stuff, but, like, you almost have to go to a specific place now. It's kind of, I don't know, it's like anything else. It makes you a little bummed, but, I mean, I'm not really buying them as much either lately. But, yeah, those are definitely good memories. I used to ride my bike forever just to go to the gas station, and, if I could get more than one pack, it was like a special day, and it was just like, because when you open that pack and you go through them all and you get maybe one that you're like really excited about and it's already over, you've already looked at your eight cards or whatever, it's kind of like, damn it.
It's like, you're right. I mean, I'm still the same way. Like, if I buy, like, I'll go on a buying binge on eBay or something and buy a couple cards that I really want, and I'm like, I'm waiting, and they come in the mail, I'm like, I got it, I open it, I'm like, this is awesome, and I put it down, I'm like, okay, what's next? Like, it's complete. It's just like over with, like, immediately. Yeah. And it's the same thing, like you said, even with buying the pack of cards. It's like, I mean, now I'm a little more knowledgeable, so I know who like the good players are and who they aren't. But back then, it was just like, is it a Mets player? Is it
exactly.
All I wanted was Daryl Strawberry or Jose Canseco.
Yeah, I definitely remember Jose Canseco being a big deal at the time. Mm-hmm. He had quite a run there for a little bit. And his rookie card was only like 2 years before that, I think, right?
Yeah, I think it was 86 was his rookie card. 86 or 87, I can't remember. But yeah, it was a really expensive. It was like one of those cards like that was like, probably like $50 to $100, right. At the time. And now it's like $2 maybe, $3, I don't know.
Unless you got some weird variant or something that like nobody has, and that one might still be worth $200 or something.
Yeah, or if it's like a really pristine copy of it, you can still get some decent. But I mean, there's people, you'd be surprised though. There are people that collect and will pay for cards, of him or some other player that might not be like necessarily like a Hall of Famer, but they still like him. I know I'm a part of a Facebook group. It's like a baseball card collecting Facebook group, and a guy on there, I believe his name is Tanner Jones or something like that. He's like this super huge Jose Canseco collector. He has like thousands of cards, of this guy, and he's like always looking for like rare art, you know what I mean? So it's something, you know, I mean, even though he was a, you know, a steroid guy, you know, I mean, people are still fans of these players because you remember how you felt when you watched them, you know, before. So like at that time you didn't know that they were cheating, so you still have good memories of watching that. You're a little disappointed, but it's the same thing with like Daryl Strawberry. Like he was a surefire Hall of Famer until he started getting injured and the drugs and all that stuff. And I remember as a kid, I didn't know that he was a jerk sometimes. And he did stuff. I just liked Daryl Strawberry. That was my dude, you know.
Right.
So, I mean, I would collect Daryl. I do have quite a few Daryl Strawberry baseball cards still, actually. So,
yeah, it's funny. My sister was big into Daryl Strawberry for some reason for a while. That was like her guy. I think it might have been like the only player's name she knew or something. But
all right, well, on that note,
yeah, that's
here
a very neat
is a little bit of the hottest song Jerry, of August Strawberry, 1988 exactly. to take us forward for the next 10 years into 1998. See you on the other side. My pick took place on August 28th of 1998, and it is the release date for the movie 54.
54, where too much was never enough.
A kid like you can get anything he wants.
Steam was in the works.
Hi, do you want to join us?
A fortune was being concealed.
What the IRS doesn't know won't hurt.
And revenge.
Help me!
Was about to make it all explode. Ryan Phillippe, Salma Hayek, with Neve Campbell and Mike Myers. 54.
54. 54. I was expecting something more epic, but
August of 98 was a dead zone for movies, especially movies I've seen, and the only other one that I considered was Blade, but I feel like I've talked about that a few times recently in the past few episodes of the show, so that was something new. But, you know, it's kind of relevant to, I think, our memories in particular, because it kind of capitalized on the 20-year trend cycle bringing back, like, having a resurgence for disco at the time. And that was pretty big, and, you know, I definitely remember... you know, I definitely remember there being some decent hype for the movie, but also I remember being caught up in the disco return for a while. Especially, I can remember like spending a whole day of shopping with you and your parents looking for the R-rated copy of Saturday Night Fever.
Yes. Yep.
Because all the stores only had the PG edit.
Yeah. Well, I remember because I was shocked because the first time I watched that, we rented it from the video store. Like Video Circus or whatever it was.
Right.
And yeah, it was very it was very appropriate. And then when I saw it again, I was like, I don't remember it being this bad. And I don't think my parents would let me watch that. So I didn't realize there was two different edits of it. But yeah, it was actually pretty bad. I mean, it wasn't bad, especially according to today's standards. But I mean, there was a lot of swearing and, you know, sexual content for something, you know. But yeah, that's kind of like the disco era, I guess, but
yeah. Well, I mean, it's like finding out, you know, there's two different versions of anything that's like opposite ends of the spectrum. I mean, PG is, you know, family friendly, you know, maybe just past that, but like the regular full R movie is, you know, it's like watching I don't know, The Godfather where nobody gets shot or something, and then finding out like the real version. Oh shit.
Well, it's funny you just mentioned that because we were watching that on like AMC showing it uncut. And there was the part where, like, you know, we were just watching it in the living room, and, like, the, you know, one of the kids are in there.
Right.
And it's that part where they're waiting to find out where Michael has to go to shoot the police captain. And Sonny's like, yeah, I don't want him to come out of the bathroom. It's just a dick, just with a dick in his hands or something like that. I'm like, they didn't edit that out. I'm like, what is going on? She's like, oh yeah, it's uncut. So anyway, back to 54 disco.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So the movie itself is, it's like a fictional plot based on the real life rise and fall of New York City's infamous Studio 54 dance club, mainly during its initial run from 77 to 1980. And the movie has kind of an ensemble cast of fairly well-known names. Some were less well-known at the time, but would go on to become well-known. But some of those include Ryan Phillippe, or Felipe, I'm not still not sure how you say that. Selma Hayek. Nev Campbell, Mike Myers, CeeLo Ward, and Breckenmeyer, among others, including several cameos from celebrities that who both were and were not at the actual Studio 54, but some of them got to play pretend for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Stallone's name on the list of cameos. I know he was definitely back there in the heyday.
Yeah.
Liza Minnelli's sister. I know Liza was there, but I don't know if she was there. But either way, it's there's a bunch of them in there. Yeah, so it opened up at number 4 at the box office, but overall it received pretty bad reviews across the board from critics. There was one exception. They gave Mike Myers some praise for what was basically the only serious dramatic role of his entire career. Mm-hmm. As Studio 54 co-founder Steve Rubell. The main problems that people had with it is critics and pretty much anyone who had a basic knowledge of the story of Studio 54 is that they didn't even need to concoct this like fictional plot when the real life history was so full of fascinating stuff. And they kind of didn't really, it took place there, but they didn't really like highlight any of that stuff.
Mm.
I remember being fairly disappointed when I saw it. I mean, I thought it was like, it looked cool, but that was about it. I don't know. Did you ever see it?
No, I have never seen the movie, actually. So,
well,
I'm not sure why, though. I mean, because like you were talking about, you know, our slight fascination with disco at the time, you think that I would have.
Yeah.
I didn't. I don't know why I never saw that.
It could be because it actually became fairly hard to find. I think the video release was significantly delayed, and and then because of the critical reception, it came out that apparently there's two different versions of this movie as well. The movie that was released is the shortest version, and it was the result of a bunch of like reshoots and cuts that the studio wanted, that the director didn't want. So then there's another one that's like 40 minutes longer and has like almost none of the studio stuff in it, and they reshowed that at some festival and apparently people loved it. I don't know, but I guess both are available on streaming, so if you want to check it out, maybe go with that version.
I might do that. I don't really have much to input on that, sorry. But well, it is funny because you said that about Mike Myers. That was what, a year after the first Austin Powers,
yeah,
wasn't it? So that's kind of, it's funny that he would, it's like a polar opposite.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
it's a weird choice to follow that up, but I guess it makes sense. You kind of want to, I mean, Austin Powers is so over the top, and I guess the two Wayne's Worlds before that and, you know, whatever, it's just kind of like, maybe just needs a change. I don't know, but it seemed to work fairly well.
Yeah. I mean, if he got praise for it, you know, he must have, I mean, he is a good actor. I mean, I remember he had a bit part in Inglourious Basterds. Have you ever seen that?
No, I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah, he was like, he plays like a British general or something. It's like maybe like a 5-minute role, but it's kind of, I can't decide if it's like funny or serious because he's doing like, you know, his British accent.
Right.
But I don't know if he's trying to be funny because, I mean, you know, it's a Tarantino movie, so it's going to be violent. But, you know, there's some humor in some of the stuff that he does. So I'm not sure if he just did that like on purpose to be funny or what, but I would say that was kind of a serious, but I wouldn't really call that a role. That was obviously just a, you know, a cameo. It's not like a real solid role or whatever.
Not a full.
I mean, he was he did like maybe a day's worth of work for that one scene. Yeah. So that was a good movie though. You should watch that. It was kind of it's kind of weird though. That was a it's kind of like an alternate reality.
Right.
Yeah. So Studio 54 was kind of like you said infamous. I mean, there was a lot of drugs and you know stuff like that involved. I mean anything really in the disco era at yeah. that point. You know, or even in the 80s, New York City, you know, it's kind of hard yeah. not to.
Drugs and sex and tax evasion.
Yeah, tax evasion, that's a good one. I'm going to do some tax evasion today.
It seems like success, like you said with Jose Canseco, or, you know, it seems like anybody in a position of success, there's some scandal underneath just waiting to be unearthed. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the common denominator is there, but apparently success or fame kind of twists your reality real quick.
Yeah. I think when you have a lot of money, too, you don't know what to do with it. You just buy drugs.
Yeah.
So, I can pay for Coke now? All right, let's try that, I guess.
Well, unfortunately, the movie version didn't really ever get to have any kind of quick success. It had a $13 million budget and basically broke even, making just under $17 million in its run. And it has a score of 4.2 out of 10 on Rotten Tomatoes and was nominated for 2 Razzie Awards, one for Ryan Phillippe as the worst actor and one for Ellen Albertini Dow, who was in a much better movie in 1998 called The Wedding Singer. She was nominated for Worst Supporting Actress.
Yeah, I never really liked Ryan Phillippe that much.
I guess Cruel Intentions was probably the best movie I saw him in, but it could have been anybody in the part.
Yeah, so I was going to say, like, that was a pretty decent movie, but, like, his role, I thought, was, like, way overacted. You know, he just acted like, I don't know, I can't even really explain it. I'm not very eloquent when it comes to me telling you why I don't like a movie, but he just was off-putting in that movie, you know?
I mean, yeah, he definitely has a kind of odd screen presence.
Yeah.
So I can kind of see what you're saying there.
Yeah, anyway.
I'm not Ryan. Blaming the failure of the movie on him or anything, but I'm sure it played its role.
Well, it's not. Yeah, I'd say it's not all his fault, but right. I'm sure it's some of his fault. So. All right, well, my pick for August of 1998 isn't even close to what you picked.
Well, that's good.
Ruined from entertainment to, like, it's about to get real.
Nice.
So, in August 20th of 1998, the U.S. Embassy bombings happened in, I believe it was Kenya and Tanzania.
These acts of terrorist violence are abhorrent. They are inhuman. We will use all the means at our disposal to bring those responsible to justice, no matter what or how long it takes. Let me say to the thousands and thousands of hardworking men and women from the State Department and from our other government agencies who serve us abroad in these embassies, the work you do every day is vital to our security and prosperity. Your well-being is therefore vital to us. And we will do everything we can to assure that you can serve in safety.
So the U.S. military launches cruise missile attacks against alleged al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan and a suspected chemical plant in Sudan in retaliation for the August 7th bombings of the American embassies. So it's weird because, to me, you know, this is an era when we were teenagers. Yeah. You know, you were 16, I was 17.
Right.
And obviously, our focus is not, is not at the world at a whole. You know, it's our own little world.
Definitely.
Our own lives are so important. You don't really pay attention to this kind of stuff. So, when, like, 9/11 happened, it kind of seemed like it was a shock, almost.
Right.
But if you were paying attention for the last, like, 20 years, you would have kind of saw it coming, almost, you know. And this is kind of almost like a red flag, you know. I mean, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have retaliated against that, but, you know, this was, you know, terrorism wasn't just like something that happened in 2001 and then,
right.
You know, we had a president that was going to declare war on terror and, you know, terrorism's bad, you know, and terrorism is a completely made up concept anyway, but a lot of this stuff was happening in the decades before 9/11, you know, and you can see things starting to, like, I mean, they're starting to swell, you know. I mean,
for sure.
Look at the Munich Olympics in the 70s with the, they took the Jewish, some of those Jewish athletes hostage and ended up murdering them and stuff. There's actually a really good movie called Munich where the Jewish Mossad gets some, like, crazy revenge against them, but right. I mean, pretty decent flick. I had Daniel Craig in it. Anyway, but, you know, a lot of this, like, terrorism type stuff was happening and we were retaliating and it was going on, you know, and it keeps building and building. And I mean, even in, what was it, 93, I think it was, where they tried to bomb the World Trade Center the first time.
Yep, 93.
So, I mean, it's not like they didn't try to go after that already, but it seems like, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal because, like, you know, not a lot of people died. Obviously, the buildings didn't come down. Right. You know, it wasn't this, like, horrible tragedy. I mean, it was still a tragedy, you know, in its own right. But, you know, all these things are happening. Then our embassies are bombed, so we got to retaliate against that. It's like, there's these, the groundwork for what's about to happen is being laid.
Right.
And to me, I was naive to it, as I'm sure you probably were as well. You know, like,
yeah.
Oh, they bombed our embassy halfway across the world. Let's get them back. And, you know, we didn't, all we had to do is push a button and shoot a missile. And yeah. That's how we got back at them. You know, it wasn't like, I don't know. I just find it kind of not shocking, but really that it happened, or that I didn't really catch it at the time. I wasn't interested in this kind of stuff, but something that went on to, you know, affect my life a little more profoundly, you know, just like a mere 3 years later.
Right.
You know, the stuff going on, you know.
Well, when you're young, I mean, 3 years is a lifetime. It's like a yep. total, especially when you're going from, you know, 17 to 20, that's like, you know, 17 is the last year that you're not 18, so you're still basically a kid. And
yeah.
20 is like, you know, you at least in your own mind, you feel like, oh, all right, well, I'm definitely an adult now. I mean, it's just a huge perspective shift. And in your case, it was definitely a huge shift in life experience, too.
Oh, yeah, I was in the military, so that was
right. weird. I mean, I definitely remember these bombings happening, but I also, wasn't the attack on the USS Cole the same year?
No, that was, I'm pretty sure that was after, I think that was after 9/11, because I think that's when,
really?
I don't know, you have to look that up.
Yeah, let me look that up, because for whatever reason, I just run them all together in my brain, mm-hmm. and, I right. mean, well, they're all attributed to Al-Qaeda, right? That could be
yeah,
why.
I think, yeah. God damn.
My typing fingers are not great.
Yeah. Like that at work too. I'm just like fat fingers. I'm like, that's not what I wanted to type. Like,
I'm seeing that it might have been in 2000. Yeah, it was in October of 2000. So it was 2 years. I mean, I guess the Al Qaeda connection is why maybe I think of them together. But I definitely remember the all of them happening and like, kind of not that they were swept under the rug, but you know, you're right. They weren't treated as this kind of giant like. Nationalistic deal.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of remember seeing them like as a footnote on the like newscast, and then kind of not again.
It's just a different world back then, you know. Now everything's
right. Yeah, well, it was so. Pre. I mean, it wasn't pre-internet, but it was pre like today's version of the internet. You know,
oh, yeah.
Everything was definitely still predominantly like television and newspaper based, and you know, not everybody had like an internet connected computer in their homes yet and stuff like that. Shit, yeah, hardly any people even had a cell phone.
Yeah. Well, yeah, those cell phones then were those big, chunky things.
Right.
Speaking of cell phones, mine's not working. Okay. Anyway, so I don't really have any much else to say about that. It's just I picked it because it was, you know, like I said, it was kind of the groundwork was being laid at that point, and we didn't even know. You know?
Right.
I mean, we as in like me and you and I.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Well, we didn't even care. Well, like you said, in 3 years, we can... We can talk about how that all changed. I guess it's time to move on to 2008 now. But first, to transition us, here once again is the number one song of August 1998.
To see the forgiveness.
back to the world of entertainment and to lighten things up, I suppose. We're going to go from my picks anyway. I'm basically taking it from a flamboyant dance club to a flamboyant dance artist. I've got to highlight another debut, and this time it's the debut of Lady Gaga with her album The Fame.
I had this dream. I really wanted to be a star. I was fearless with my ambitions. My name is Lady Gaga.
Good choice.
Thank you.
I almost picked that one, actually, but...
Oh, I'm glad you didn't. or did you really? And are you scrambling now to change it?
No, I didn't. I swear I haven't. Nice. I typed it up right here, what I picked.
Sweet. Yeah, so this was released August 19th, 2008, to be specific, on Interscope Records, and it's Lady Gaga's first major label release. You know, she would have probably been right at home at Studio 54, come to think of it. The album peaked at number 2 on the Billboard 200 chart, and at the same time, it stayed at number 1 on the dance/electronic albums chart for 107 total weeks. To date, the album has sold just shy of 5 million copies in the U.S., and 5 singles were released from it, including 2 number ones, a top 5, and a top 10. Mm-hmm. It went on to be nominated for 5 Grammys, and it won 2 of them. One for Best Electronic/Dance Album, and one for Best Dance Recording for the single Poker Face, which took the world by storm when that came out. Yeah. I mean, kind of like the disco thing in 98. I definitely got caught up for a bit in Gaga fever to some extent. She did take a couple of months to win me over initially, but because, you know, I'm generally anti-pop, so whatever's kind of current, I'm just kind of like, that sucks. Once I saw the whole package that she was presenting between, you know, her appearance and use of visuals combined with the super catchy songs, I had to admit I was pretty hooked. How did you feel?
You know, what made it so good besides it being like super catchy, because that's usually what I find pop music to be, is some kind of catchiness to it, you know, where you end up liking it because it's stuck in your head all day and you really don't have any choice. I don't know, but you already explained it.
Well, part of the thing that won me over, I think, once I kind of paid attention to her and looked into like what she really was, is, you know, unlike many, many of her peers and contemporaries, she can fucking sing, like sing, and she can play several instruments. And so it's like, it was so refreshing that there was an actual talented musician underneath like the gloss for a change.
Right.
One of my, I guess, coolest Lady Gaga related memories from that period is being at a club in Salem, Massachusetts on Halloween, and you know, her first single Just Dance came on and everybody in the place lost their shit. It was just hundreds of people in all sorts of insane costumes just getting down to this quote-unquote new artist, Lady Gaga. For some reason that just sticks out. I don't know, it was like the moment where everybody kind of stopped being like little pockets of doing whatever and just kind of acted as one. It was pretty sweet.
Yeah, those are cool moments, you know. Yeah. Kind of like at a baseball game and, you know, right, or something like that, and everyone's just kind of chit-chatting and nothing's going on, but then all of a sudden it's like tied, yep, bottom of the ninth, you know, 2 outs, and everyone's like, you know, a collective gasp. I do remember when I heard Just Dance, I believe it was on the radio when I was in my car, because that's the only time I listen to music, really, anyway. Well, I mean, sometimes if I'm on the computer, but...
Right.
Yeah, I remember I did find the style of her songs to be kind of disco-esque for like our time.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, it wasn't like you know, a lot of the pop stuff that was going on at the time. And, you know, like you said, she actually does, you know, write things, and there's a real talent behind that. It's not just like people writing stuff for her. And, you know, there's like five producers for like one song that just repeats the same word over and over. You know what I mean? It was refreshing. But yeah, it was definitely, I remember how successful it was. It was like a Grammy, you know, like you said, numerous Grammy nominations and wins and stuff like that. So
right.
Anyway, yeah, that was a really successful. I mean, I liked it too. You know, I remember, you know, I liked Bad Romance. Was that from that album or is that a later album?
That was the next one after this one.
Okay, but I like that song too, a little bit.
Yeah, that was huge. That was,
yeah,
that was a great one. I liked her kind of, I guess wholeheartedly is the word I'm looking for, up until I think Born This Way came out. And yeah. She, I mean, I don't know, it's just the songs weren't as strong for me, and just the style had changed. And, you know, you got to do that as an artist. You got to kind of evolve and change. But I just wanted her to keep being this, like, pop powerhouse, I guess. And she had other plans.
Well, she ran out of her mojo. You know?
Yeah. Well, what's cool on that album is, I believe, well, 2008, I believe, was the year that we first saw Bruce Springsteen live.
2009.
Was it 9?
Yes.
Damn it, that doesn't fit my narrative. But what's cool about Born This Way is I believe it has Clarence Clemens' final performance and his guesting on her song Edge of Glory, I think it was. He played a sax part.
Oh, yeah. Huh. Yeah, forgot all about that. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was saying, because he was definitely at that concert that we saw. Pretty sure it was 09. Yeah, it was the same year Grandma died. So,
yeah, that would be 9. Yep. Yeah. Oh, I'm thinking, okay, 08 was when I went to see Motley Crue for the first time. So,
yeah.
They all start to run together, I guess.
Yeah, that's starting to. I'm like, when did we? I mean, geez, even when we went and saw them, that was like, what, like 6 years ago now? 7 years ago?
Yeah, I think it was 2011.
Yeah, they played with Poison. So,
yep.
Yeah, that was a good concert. I like that concert. It was fun.
Definitely. Well, what do you have for the great month of August in the year 2008?
Once again, completely on the other side of whatever we're talking about, but on August 27th, Barack Obama becomes the first African-American to be nominated by a major political party for president of the United States.
Madam Secretary, the convention suspend the procedural rules and suspend the further conduct of the roll call vote. All votes cast by the delegates will be counted, and that I move Senator Barack Obama of Illinois be selected by this convention by acclamation as the nominee of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, there's no understating how huge that is.
I was going to say, I don't really think I need to explain why that's a big deal. So I picked Barack Obama. I mean, he eventually became the first black president.
Well, it's weird because Barack Obama is kind of, if we're being honest, kind of the political equivalent of Lady Gaga, in the sense of that I had never fucking ever heard of him until that. It was just like this, oh, here he is. wait, what? You know?
Yeah. I actually heard of him before, because I used to work at Barnes & Noble. Mm. And when he was senator, he wrote a book. It was not Audacity of Hope. It was the one before that. I can't remember the name of it. But I was interested because it was one of those books that a lot of people were asking about. You know, where I lived in Virginia, there was a very large black population, you know. So, of course, he was, you know, a positive figure in that community. And a lot of people were asking about it. So I looked at the, the book flap to see like who he was. And I was like, oh, he's a senator, you know, and I never heard of him until that point either. So,
right.
I did know who he was when, you know, it came out. I was like, oh yeah, that was the guy that wrote that book that everybody liked, you know what I mean? So, but yeah, if you didn't, you know, if you weren't in that specific situation I was in, like, you wouldn't have known who he was either. But
well, it's just weird because, like, I got into politics and stuff during, like, the, you know, from 2000 on, definitely after 9/11, so in the Bush years, And I was pretty steadily following it, you know, probably a little too much from that point forward. And somehow still, you know, I just never heard the name Barack Obama once in my life before that.
Well, you know, during those years, though, I mean, there was a lot of, I'm not sure what I'm trying to say, but there was a lot of things that, you know, would distract you from that kind of,
yeah,
you know, with like the Iraq War, you know, the war in Afghanistan, you know, like the Patriot Act, like Dick Cheney, you know, like right. all, like, man, don't get me started with that guy. yeah, it's like all that stuff. There's a lot of like what a lot of people saw as negative. You know, there was like the suspension of like civil liberties and just all this crazy nonsense. There was like there was the Guantanamo Bay stuff with the torture. There was the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq with that torture scandal. You know, I mean, there's so many things going on that were just terrible at that time. So
that's true.
And then Barack came, and I have to say, today as I sit here, I kind of miss Barack Obama. You know, I mean, I didn't agree with like everything he did, but you know, he was kind of like the status quo. You know what I mean? For the most part, and
well, the country I think misses him, but he put the best face of, you know, professionalism on the presidency, and that is definitely not what is happening now.
No. Not we don't have to get into a political
right thing. Yeah, but no, I know what you mean.
Yeah, but yeah, it's just, it's like, I mean, like I said, you know, I might not have agreed with everything, but I didn't worry about anything, you know, as much as I do now. I'm just like, God, what's gonna happen next, you know?
Right.
Anyway, so it was obviously significant because he became the first African-American nominee and later on president. And actually I remember too, my roommate at the time was very involved in his political campaign too, actually, up here in Saratoga. You know, so I remember that was kind of a big deal for her as well, also being an African-American.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I think actually his campaign is probably, I mean, like I said, I didn't really get into paying attention to politics until 2001. So, that's only like 7 years before this. So I don't have much to go on, but in terms of my memory and life experiences, his campaign was probably the most participatory I've seen people, you know, get as far as like taking action and like trying to get signatures and trying to go out and like knock on doors and things like that. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, just the buzz around me was a lot more active then for him.
Yeah. Well, and he's like the first candidate that leveraged social media too to get his word out. You know, I mean, he was huge on like Facebook and stuff like that to get people active and, you know, to get to know who he was and what he wanted. So he definitely appealed to a younger generation at the time too. And I think that's kind of what he was almost like. I wouldn't say he was focused on like the younger generation, but it was definitely geared towards them a little bit more, you know? So yeah, he definitely leveraged what he had at the time to.
Yeah, and you know, I want to say Twitter started in 08 or around there.
Yeah.
So that kind of lines up.
Yep.
Okay, I just looked it up. I guess it's officially created in 2006, but I mean, obviously it wasn't catching fire right out of the gate.
Well, yeah, it wasn't like popular as soon as it came out.
Right. So yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Barack Obama and Lady Gaga. Boom.
Did you see his episode on the new David Letterman show at all?
No, I did see him in Comedians in Cars getting coffee, but I did not see. Yeah. You know, I had the Dave Letterman thing queued up. I want to watch it really bad, but I just, you know, we're watching other stuff and I don't have the time at the moment. But
yeah,
I didn't know he was on that. That's pretty cool.
Well, it's interesting because if you watch the Comedians in Cars, that's while he's still in office.
Right.
And then the Dave Letterman thing is after. Mm. So you kind of get two different versions or whatever.
Probably definitely more candid now than he was back then, you know, having to say the right thing all the time. That's probably gets annoying after a while.
Well, I will say is I will never know because Dave Letterman doesn't exactly ask him any serious questions.
Oh, really?
So, I mean, it's Dave, it's a quality program, but he could have been a little more, Yeah, let's just say young Dave wouldn't have approached it the same way. I don't think.
Probably not. But young Dave. Yeah, he's got that huge beard now, doesn't he?
Like, oh, yeah.
It's like Santa Claus or something. Like that. That's cool. All right. Well, that does it for me.
I guess, yeah, our journey through decades past is over for the month of August. We'll see you in September.
September.
Three, two, one.
Pop.